This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow is producing, signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services and from Jerry Lane Chevrolet. And in studio is Bunny Cannon.
Good morning.
Last name is familiar to anybody who's from Louisiana. Her father was the late, great Billy Cannon. Great All-American, as J.C. Politz said when he ran 89 yards to beat Ole Miss in 1959. And that was 10 years before Bunny was born. But Billy and Dodd had five kids. Bunny is the last of the five. Her birth date is 8-4, and her father was born on this date in 1937. He would have been 85 years old. It started near Philadelphia, Mississippi, where he was born, and then he died on the 20th day of May, 2018, in St. Francisville. And Bunny, ironically, that was the day that LSU's second Heisman Trophy winner signed with the Tigers.
Correct. I say he passed the torch and went home.
And Joe Burrow, of course, is now a legend in his own right. But Billy Cannon grew up in this town, and he had some ups and downs, and he was on this show a few times. 7 years ago, he was on this program. We'll hear a snippet from that interview before we part company with Bunny this morning. But he grew up north side of the city, which at that time was a good part of town, and it still is, but of course it has its problems, and it was near the plants. His dad, when Billy was young, had a real health issue, didn't he?
Yes, he was. He worked at one of the plants downtown, Exxon, and which is why they came to Baton Rouge. My dad would always say that if you were smart, you would follow the 3 R's: reading, writing, and the road to Baton Rouge. And so they came here for work, and he fell off one of the scaffolding, and he eventually lost his leg. I think gangrene set in, and he lost his leg. So he was out of work for a long time. I think my dad was in junior high at the time. And so the whole family kind of had to go to work at that point.
And Billy was a superhuman athlete, and here his father was an invalid. And when I say superhuman, his exploits all these years later hold up. He was about 6'1 and 215 pounds and ran a 9.500 and went and won the SEC shot put competition on the fly. And an observer said if he gained 20 pounds, he'd be the world's strongest man. And if he lost 20 pounds, he'd be the world's fastest man. And I'm sure genes had a lot to do with it. And, of course, his son, your brother, Billy Jr., was quite an athlete, and he got hurt.
They came from big people in Neshoba County, Mississippi. So they were all, I think, red hair, 6 to 7 feet tall. I had an aunt who was 7 feet tall and had red hair.
7 feet tall?
7 feet tall. Now, I don't know if she played sports because she was a little older by the time I came along, but yes, they came from very, very big people.
And he did things that nobody was doing, had a very good pro career, but even then, Billy, by his own admission, was gaming the system. He signed a contract with the Los Angeles Rams, and then when the Houston Oilers gave him more money, he signed a contract with the Houston Oilers, and Pete Rozelle, the future commissioner, who was general manager of the Rams, took Billy to court and lost.
Yep, he did.
And I remember Pete Rozelle, the one time I was actually with Peter Finney. He was talking more to Peter Finney than to me, but he saw Peter Finney and he knew the story, of course, and he walks up, this was in the Superdome, he says, "How's that unsophisticated country boy doing up there in Baton Rouge?" And he was talking about your dad.
He would work, when I worked at the LSU Law School, one of the law professors, Chaney Joseph, says, "Well, you know, y'all are famous." And I thought he was going to talk about football, and he talked about the court case and how they still talked about that escapade, I guess you could call it.
Now, of the five children, you're considered the most like your father.
I think so. I've come to embrace it after about 50 years, so.
So I imagine there were some collisions every now and then.
Growing up, we had a few. We thought a lot alike. There were many times where I don't think he knew what to do with me. He would shake his head. But at the end of the day, I think we all agreed what was right, and it was to listen to him.
Mm-hmm. But when you were growing up, he was always a legend until the day he died. But you, when you were, 13 years old, you had to deal with his scandal, and that had to be very difficult for a kid in school.
It was hard. It was very hard. But, you know, at the time I was in a really good school, Trafton Academy, which is now the Dunham School. And I was surrounded by a lot of people. And so while everything was kind of whirling around us, I stayed kind of grounded. And I thank God for those people there because they helped pull me through that. Because it's hard for a teenage kid going through that.
We're visiting with Bunny Cannon, youngest child of Billy Ab Cannon, and a beautiful mother who stood by Billy through thick and thin.
Absolutely. She's 84 years old.
And they were married when they were freshmen.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, they met in junior high, and they fell in love when they're in their senior year. Mm-hmm. And I asked her one time if she liked him when he was in junior high, and she goes, "Not too much." I said, "Okay." So they got married right, I think he had just started football, November of 56. And then they had my sister Terry in September of 57, Gina, September of 58, and Dara, September of 59. So when he left LSU, he had three daughters.
Three daughters, and then Billy Jr. was born.
61.
And you were born in 1969.
69. They thought I was spinal meningitis. They thought she was sick with that because she had had that several years before. So.
Well, you turned out well, and Bunny is keeping the legacy alive, and there is an immense legacy, and we should always remember Billy Cannon. And I've said on this show before that the most interesting people in the world are those with great strengths and significant weaknesses. And your dad fits that description about as well as anybody I've ever met.
Yeah, he did. He was very smart. A lot of people don't realize how smart he was. He could quote history, was a history lover, loved science, very, very smart. And but sometimes he would have lapses in judgment. But we all do. We're human. And I think that's the biggest part of him is he was so incredible at so many things, but he was human. And what he did at Angola, mm-hmm. the last part of his life, I'm very proud of because he, even though the people that were there had done bad things, he treated them as human. And that's why they called him Legend.
Legend at Angola, where he was the dentist for...
22, 23 years.
And he was working on people's teeth who, of course, most of them died in that prison.
Right.
But he did it... like he did everything else, full bore, put everything he had into it. Now, he did have his issues, and as mentioned, his father was an invalid, and when he was a teenager, he was running the streets, and he got in trouble. And 7 years ago, when Charlie D. Gravel wrote the book with Billy, A Long, Long Run, which is one of the best sports books ever written about a Louisiana sports legend. I would rank John Ed Bradley's It Never Rains in Tiger Stadium as probably the best book. But this one is in the top 10. And when he was on this program, he talked about it, and it's mentioned in his book, about his issues as a young man when he took advantage of others. Robin, let's give it a listen. This is 2015, if we can pull it up. Billy Cannon with Charlie D. Gravel, who were in this studio. And here we go.
A little retrospect.
And I've never heard those stories. I've heard about them, but I finally got what really happened.
In fact, I saw one of my cohorts in some of the exposés and the troubles that we got into, who was later very successful in life. And I saw him at a get-together, and he said, "Billy, how stupid were we?" I said, "We were not only stupid, we were criminal." And we were. Not exploiting... our manlihood or anything, but taking advantage of people in awkward situations. They talk about that we would rob homosexuals, and we did that. And they would say that we would rob other people with threats of violence, and we did. And for instance, you would catch a deacon of the church leaving his girlfriend's house. Very awkward situation. He would give us his wallet, his watch, or whatever we wanted. back then they didn't have credit cards. So years later, when I was being recruited to go to universities, this would always come up. And I was always guilty, which I was. And we got caught. And we got put on probation. There were a number of us. And, of course, that didn't make the headlines. Billy Cannon made the headlines. And it was funny because what we were doing was wrong. We knew it was wrong. But it was adventurous. It was fun. And it was profitable. There was not a lot of money on the north side.
Billy Cannon, and we'll get some more reflections from his daughter about a remarkable life that he turned around and lived exemplary in the final years back after this. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Bunny Cannon is in the house, the fifth child, the youngest of Billy and Dot Cannon, Billy Cannon. LSU's great All-American, protege of Alvin Roy, built himself into a muscle man and a speed demon, and was one of the great athletes of his time or any time. Born on this date 85 years ago near Philadelphia, Mississippi, he died the 20th of May, 2018 in St. Francisville. He was 80 years old, and he is relevant, always will be, in this town. He went to Estruma High School. They had some of the best teams in the country when he was doing things that few others have or ever will do. He was an amazing athlete. And of course, at the time LSU won the championship in 1958, the three most well-known players were Cannon, Johnny Robinson, and Warren Rabb, who all went to Baton Rouge high schools and were rivals in high school, but boy, did they blend together and remain friends throughout their lives, very close friends. And I remember when Billy went to jail, when he got arrested, the first person I called was Johnny Robinson, and he cried.
Yeah, they were friends till the very end.
Very end.
And he called Warren Rabb Samuel, and I think Warren called my dad William, which was not his name. His name was Billy. It was on his birth certificate as Billy, but he called him, so it was William and Samuel. Why, I have no idea.
Well, Sam, I think that is Warren Rabb's
first name,
and Billy, he didn't like him in high school, but they became the best of friends. Another guy who I think we should mention is Bud Johnson, who was the guy who was the publicist for LSU sports in those days and wrote the definitive book about that season, the perfect season. He died a few weeks ago, and what a remarkable life he led, and he was extremely close to your father.
Very, very good friends. And my dad did a lot of things that Bud wanted him to do simply because Bud asked him to do it. An interview or go into a Hall of Fame or a signing, whatever it was, he did it if Bud mm-hmm. asked. He was a true gentleman and a good friend.
Well, Bud got Billy and me together. Without him, I never would have interviewed him, but I interviewed him many times. And he was very gracious. He never hesitated from tough questions.
No, never did.
You know, when on the 50th anniversary of the run, it was because of Bud, I interviewed Billy Cannon and Warren Rabb. It was October 31st, 2009, and I asked Billy about the counterfeiting thing, and some people were offended that I was spoiling an anniversary celebration. Billy didn't care. He didn't care at all.
Well, you know, it happened. One thing I can say about him is whatever was happening, we had humor in our lives. All growing mm-hmm. up, in the worst of times, he told a story, I think, one time to one of his coaches came in and said, Billy, how can I help you? He goes, you got change for 100? That was a true story. It was Boots Garland.
Yeah.
And, you know, we always had humor. And so even at the worst mm-hmm. of times, and it was bad, mm-hmm. but we always had humor, and it always came from him. He could give you a one-liner. He would zing you before you even knew you got it.
Well, he told the story on our show. Pardon me. But he was having some financial problems, and his next-door neighbor, there we go, was John Stiglitz, a notorious counterfeiter who had already been arrested and gone to jail. And Stiglitz tells him, you know, Billy, we can do this. And Billy said, well, okay. So they do it. and the counterfeit bills were so good, the Secret Service knew immediately there was only one person in the world who could have pulled this off, and his name was John Stiglitz.
Wow.
So they show up at Stiglitz's house, and it was a pretty easy catch.
Yep.
And Billy says he and your mother were driving into the place on Government Street they used to go to, Bill's Oyster Bar, and got stopped by the Secret Service. And as they say, the rest is history. But in those 2.5 years he was away in prison, how were those years for you?
You know, like I said, I was surrounded by a lot of really, really good people who I still talk to today. And while it was out there, it wasn't first and foremost. Of course, when you're a teenage girl, you have a lot of other things going on in your world that are way more important, like dances and things like that, and sports. But, you know, it was hard, but we went and saw him a lot, and he was always, even in prison, he was a fun-loving guy, always had humor. It was tough on him, but we weathered the storm.
Mike in Villa Del Rey. Mike, you're on Talk Louisiana with Bunny Cannon.
Hey, good morning. Well, the years that I went to Estruma High, I know people, students that I'm assuming parents didn't have insurance or couldn't afford it. They were sent to Dr. Cannon's office for free dental work. And I know that happened. I don't know what the financial situation was, but he did free dental work for students while I was there.
He did.
That's all that.
He did. He did a lot of that. He, you know, I think coming up and having nothing, he felt for people who needed things. And so he always gave everything that he had. He'd give the shirt off his back if he could. And there were many, many patients that he took, so much so that when he sold his practice, I think right before he went to prison, he asked Dr. Kibach to take the people who couldn't pay and couldn't afford it. And Kibach said, Billy, I'll do anything in the world for you. What? Just tell me what you need and give me the list, you know, have them come here. And Kibach, who did my braces later on, he said, Bunny, he goes, it was over 200 people. He said, and I had to do it, he said, because I gave him my word, but I would never take 200 people without paying anything. So he did a lot of good things for a lot of people.
David in Atlanta. David, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Was there a reason you could think of why Mr. Cannon played for the AFL, for the Houston Oilers, rather than going into the NFL? I'm sure he would have done well in the NFL.
And he led the Oilers to the first title of the AFL, first player drafted.
Yeah, he was drafted by the AFL and the NFL and went with the AFL because they gave him more money.
Yeah.
And he had three kids, one on the way, and there wasn't NIL back then, so that was his NIL.
Yeah, he didn't get rich playing college football.
I believe in 1960 he was the wealthiest athlete in the world, making $50,000 a year.
Yeah, it wasn't. He got a bonus, but he wasn't making the kind of money they make now, of course. And Denny McClain, who of course was the best pitcher in baseball in the late 60s, he says Clayton Kershaw makes more in three innings than in a year than he made in a whole year.
Wow.
So that's the way it was. And these guys had to work in the off season.
And
they were not set for life when they retired. And your dad, he was a character. And as fate would have it, he was united in Oakland with another character.
Right.
Al Davis. And they were kindred souls, weren't they?
They were. And actually, if I were a boy, that would have been my name, Al Davis Cannon.
Because you were born when he was playing for the Raiders.
Well, I think actually he had just been let go by the Raiders. But he was going to name me after him. So I'm glad I was a girl, even though Bunny's not the name I would have chosen. But
but your dad is mentioned. His pro career was underrated. He led the AFL in rushing, but at the end of his career, he became the first speedy guy to play tight end.
Right.
And he was part of the Oakland passing array. The mad bomber Daryl LaMonica was throwing to him, and he was catching touchdown passes as a tight end, and he really revolutionized the position.
Yeah, I think he was one of the handful of people that were all pro at two different positions. And so I don't think he wanted to move positions, but he had gotten a little bit slower, and he had a back injury.
Mm-hmm.
So
And it is interesting that he came back home. He could have lived in a lot of places, but
this was God's country, he called it.
He came back to Baton Rouge, and he came back here after he got out of jail.
He did.
And he took his medicine. I don't think a jury in Baton Rouge now, it might have been a hung jury, but I don't think a jury would have convicted Billy Cannon of what he was charged with.
And well, he always took his medicine, and he always came clean. I told the story earlier. He was like a dog that would punish himself and go sit under the sofa if he did something wrong. So,
well, he was a fine man, and underneath that tough exterior was really a prince of a human being, and he had a great kindness and soul, and I'm glad he didn't suffer. He died quickly, and his legacy is immense, and it lives on with one Bunny Cannon, who someday will write her book about her dad. And I'm sure we'll hear stories we've never heard before. Thank you, Bunny.
Thank you.
We'll be back with more Talk Louisiana after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. And we're joined in studio now by Matt Kenyon. He is a nationally acclaimed artist, and he is here in his hometown to be part of an exhibit that will be unveiled tomorrow night at the Baton Rouge Gallery. And the guy in charge there, Jason Andreessen, is in the studio as well. But Matt Kenyon is, I guess, in some ways a prophet in his own land. He is known far and wide. Went to Southeastern, right?
That's correct.
And where did you go to a school here in Baton Rouge?
I went to River Oaks Elementary and Westdale Middle, and then followed up with Southeastern University for undergraduate school.
So, and Southeastern, I suspect, had a very good program.
Oh, yeah. Yep, I benefited a lot. I studied mostly painting and printmaking back in the day, and I attended high school in a very rural part of Kansas. And so it was my lucky break to return
to Louisiana.
Graduate, undergraduate.
Well, Matt is in his mid-40s, and he is renowned as one of the top new media artists. He's a guy who's involved in something called SWAMP. Tell us about S-W-A-M-P.
Well, SWAMP stands for Studies of Work Atmospheres and Mass Production, and it was the name of I gave my studio at the time that I was living in Hammond, Louisiana. And at the time, I was collaborating with another artist named Doug Easterly.
And what was the big break? Or was there a moment where you learned or you felt like, you know, I've turned the corner on this?
Well, the first big SWAMP project actually is going to be, one of the first SWAMP projects is in the show that opens tomorrow, and it's called Spore. And it's a self-contained ecosystem for a rubber tree plant purchased from Home Depot. And the Home Depot stock value that rises and falls is responsible for watering the plant.
Yes.
And if the plant dies, I return it to Home Depot with a receipt, and they replace the plant for free.
I'll be darned. Now, you've been doing this since, what, like late 90s, right?
Yep. SWAMP started in 1999.
99, so according to my math, that's 23 years. And what are some of the other endeavors that you've been involved with SWAMP?
Well, probably the most famous project is the Notepad, which looks like an everyday mm-hmm. yellow legal tablet that lawyers might carry. But all of the lines on the paper are microprinted text and contain details of individual Iraqi civilians that died as a result of the U.S. invasion. And what I did and continue to do is smuggle it into the stationery supply of the U.S. and coalition governments so it goes under the noses of people in power who authorized and continue to authorize violence in that area.
Your number, if you'd like to join our conversation and our time with Matt Kenyon, is 877-217-5757. The exhibit is Cloudburst, the work of Matt Kenyon. It'll open tomorrow. First Wednesday of every month, there is an opening at the Baton Rouge Gallery, and this is 6 to 9 p.m. It's free, open to the public. And the guy who runs the show there has been in our studio a time or two, Jason Andreessen. I know you've tried for a few years to get this guy to come here, haven't you?
We have. It started back in 2018. We were actually just talking before we came on air about the ups and downs of planning this exhibition. It's been in the works for a long time, and we're thrilled to see it up now.
You teach art as well, don't you?
Yep. I teach at the University at Buffalo, and I'm also the graduate director there. So if there are any artists in Baton Rouge in the Louisiana area who are looking for graduate school.
So you're living in Buffalo, which some might not regard as like a mecca for artists, but sounds like it is.
Buffalo is a great place for artists. It's a place where artists can afford studio space. We have a fully funded graduate program, and we're the second largest city in the New York State.
There is one larger than Buffalo, though.
There is. It's really big.
Really big.
But it's just a train ride away.
Do we have the appreciation for art that we should in our country? Or should more people take note of the kinds of work that you do, and of course many others do, in every kind of realm you can imagine?
Well, I wouldn't be here, I think, today if there wasn't appreciation, and I'm really grateful to the folks at the Baton Rouge Gallery, Kelsey, Gwen, Jonathan, and of course Jason, who helped put this show together. I think we could have more support for art in our culture, definitely. The funding, the art level funding, and the especially funding for arts education always is the first on the chopping block, and I'd like to see that change.
And sometimes people view artists as those who are immune from what's happening in the real world. You just told us about a real world situation that you used as a catalyst for art. That can be a good thing when you find something that's not so pleasant and you do something to express your point of view.
Yeah. Well, one of the works in the show that I'm really excited to install here and really was the center is the centerpiece of the show is a piece called Tide that was informed by the 2016 Great Flood in Baton Rouge that affected so many, including every member of my family, you know, was impacted and continues to, you know, all pay right. the price for that.
Mm-hmm. We're hearing the voice of Matt Kenyon, a renowned artist who spent much of his formative years in Baton Rouge, got his BFA from Southeastern and his MFA from Virginia Commonwealth. Now, people ask about your background here, and that's a question from Holly in the Garden District about how formative and how influential were those years in Baton Rouge as a young boy. Did you have some mentor here who propelled you to where you are now?
Well, my art teacher from Westdale, Mr. Talbot, was probably my first greatest influence and someone that, you know, I think about a lot in my classroom and then my professor.
Well, keep going.
Yeah, my professors at Southeastern, Barbara Tardo, Roy Blackwood, Alexander Stolen, all these just really talented individuals helped me in my painting practice and then and beyond, yeah.
You know, I love the way you mention your professors. Recently, I interviewed a gentleman for a position, and he had a degree from LSU, and he couldn't name one professor at
really?
LSU.
Oh, no, goodness.
And I asked some people here about whether I was too hard on the guy, and they said, of course you were. We can't name any of our professors
either. Oh, no.
But you named your professors.
Absolutely.
I mean, come on.
Yeah, and I remember Gail Hood. Like, I remember painting. It was a landscape painting class, and she said, it's not about the marks you're making. It's about training your eye to see. And she said, look at those trees. They're not brown. They're purple, like they, because of the way the light was hitting them. And I think slowing down and learning to see is something that artists, you know, of course, it's part of our training, but I think also with appreciation and understanding of art. And the landscape doesn't mean a group of trees. It could be an oil refinery at the edge of town.
Well, you mentioned Westdale a couple of times, which prompts Tom on Bluebonnet to ask about a guy who is now deceased, but he did the Westdale Monument, Ted DeMuro. Do you remember him?
Yeah, I didn't know he had.
Yeah, but yeah. But they tore that down. I liked it. I may not have been in the majority, but I liked it. Yeah, the Westdale Monument.
I went to school with his daughter as well, and I remember his big clay extrusion machine, and we built these aqueducts out of these tiny little handmade bricks. Yeah, he was a great influence.
Well, is art something that is tangible, or can you just? You say, look, I'm an artist, and whatever you do is art. How do you view it?
Well, art That's a complicated, that's a whole nother show, but I think it can exist in a bunch of different ways. And I'm excited to have work that is experiential, that you have to see with your eyes in person, and then also art that circulates almost like a story. Like once you see, and I'm looking at you have a notepad in front of you, once you see one of these notepads in the show, I hope it will change the way that you see the everyday objects around you, from a house key to a notepad to the rain that's falling outside right now.
Well, the fact that we are tethered so much to our gadgets now, is that an impediment to art?
Well, artists are like cultural judo masters. They take the things that might hold us back, all that cultural weight and power, and they try to spin it so that it does something cross-purpose. And mm-hmm. so I think, you know, technology definitely isn't can be a problem, but I think the way that we use it, there's this great quote by one of these punk rock musicians I love, Jello Biafra. He says, "Don't hate the media, be the media," right? And and culture is not something that just happens to us, right? We actively participate in making it.
Well, you can hear there's a lot going on in this gentleman's head, Matt Kenyon, and he expresses it in art in a way that he is now on the vanguard of new media art, and it will be on display with Matt present tomorrow night. Matthew Kenyon will be at the Baton Rouge Gallery, and Jason Andreessen, you do this every month, and every month you have outstanding artists, but this is a person who's not only a local legend of sorts, but he is known far and wide.
Yeah, this was really a special undertaking for us. As you mentioned, we've got monthly exhibitions that typically focus in on Louisiana and Baton Rouge artists. But a few years ago, back in 2018, being that we are an artist cooperative at heart, we went to the artist members and started having a discussion about the idea of having one special exhibition each year where we would bring in an artist or curator from outside of the Baton Rouge or Louisiana area to really try and broaden the conversation happening around contemporary art in our area. And that led to this mm-hmm. show.
Now, you mentioned the notepad. That's one of your best-known works mm-hmm. 15 years ago, and it still has relevance, obviously.
I mail it out every couple months to people all over the world. But at tomorrow's opening at this exhibition, Cloudburst, we'll have a brand new project that uses the same microprinting techniques and also a project called Alternative Rule that commemorates and resists gun violence in our schools.
Well, it's tomorrow night, 6 to 9 p.m., Baton Rouge Gallery, City Park, and you can go by anytime, Tuesday through Sunday as well, from 12 to 6 p.m. Thank you, Matt. Thank you, Jason. We're back after this. This is Jim Inkster. Good to have you with us for Talk Louisiana. In our last quarter hour, we're joined by Dr. Chantel Pratt. Her book is The Neuroscience of You, How Every Brain is Different and How to Understand Yours. Dr. Pratt is a professor at the University of Washington with appointments in the departments of psychology, neuroscience, and linguistics. She is on the front lines of an issue that, of course, is relevant to all of us. We all want to have healthy brains, and we're learning more and more, Dr. Pratt, about what makes our brains tick. And it is a complex world, but your book goes there. And I like the preface, "From My Brain to Yours." What are some of the big revelations that you have come to know in the last few years?
Well, in the last few years, I think one of the biggest revelations I've come to understand is just that it's easier for us to connect with other people whose brains work like ours. And this is something that I've come to know both personally and professionally in writing the book and spelling out all of the different ways that different brains build our reality and our interpretation of the world around us. I also learned a lot from the field of social neuroscience, where we're finding repeatedly that you can predict how close of friends two people will be. Any two people in a graduate program, any two people on an island in South Korea, you can figure out how closely these people will get along, how closely they'll relate to one another based on how similar their brains are. And I just wanted to give people the tools to help them understand brains that work differently, because it's just much easier to figure out people who work like we do.
Well, I'm sure there are many who haven't given this much thought and think that brains are brains and that the environment is what causes us to think the way we do. And there may be some truth to that, but it is an extremely intricate matter, isn't it, as far as how our brains work and how we get to where we are and how we're compatible with some people because of the way our brains work and we're not compatible with others.
That's right. And extremely intricate is a great description. It's so complicated. And I think one important thing to note is that, you know, you were saying a brain is a brain and it's in the environment, but the environment gets in your brain. I mean, one of the most quintessential things about the human brain is how adaptable it is. I think we all experienced this with the COVID pandemic. Like, the vast majority of our day-to-day activities completely changed. And here we are many years into this, and we heard the buzzword, the new normal. But really, so many things that we took for granted have completely changed, and we get used to it. So the environment gets laid down in your brain. Your brain becomes wired to predict and operate in a particular environment. So a brain is a brain, but you put this brain in the environment, and the environment shapes it. That's one thing. And on the other hand, I mean, I know as well as anyone that we don't all think the same, but I think most people, if you have siblings, if you have children, if you're behaving in a world and noticing people around you, it seems pretty obvious that we don't all work the same. So people say things like, I'm not wired that way. It shows that they understand something about how their brain works drives their behavior. They just don't really know what.
The book is The Neuroscience of You, How Every Brain is Different and How to Understand Yours. Now, if we're attracted to somebody, maybe as a friend or as a lover, and they don't think the way we do, even though there may be immense attraction in other ways, is that a prescription for disaster?
I hope not. I mean, I certainly think my husband and I are very different, and I think that's wonderful. If you think about it, we are social creatures. We evolved to solve problems and exist in groups. And if we all worked exactly the same, you know, we would just be replicating ourselves. Essentially, we'd be a bigger body, more mouths to feed. If we all work a little bit different, we can collaborate, right? So I don't think that it's a recipe for disaster. I think it's just a little bit more difficult. And that's where hormones like oxytocin come in to help us, help motivate us to do the work to understand a human with a brain that works differently.
And what happens if two people are basically one person rolled into two? Does that work?
I think that you strengthen the connection between two people when somebody feels seen or heard or understood. And your ability to understand someone is really, at the end of the day, based on how well you can reverse engineer what's driving their behavior, what's going on in their brain that makes them say and do the things that they say and do. So I think it's probably much easier to understand and connect with someone who works like you.
You also note, Dr. Pratt, that people learn differently, that we obviously, if we don't learn, we're basically dead, but we don't learn in the same way, do we?
No, and you know, almost everyone will tell you, I'm a visual learner or I'm an experiential learner. But one of the most salient differences in how people learn is something that very few are aware of, and that's whether we learn more about the outcomes. It's how we learn about the outcomes of our actions. And there are two pathways in the brain. We talk a lot about reinforcement learning and reward, and most artificial intelligence works in this way, like moving toward good things. But in the human brain, there's another path that moves us away from bad things. It learns to avoid the actions that you take that turn out less good than you think. And different people learn more strongly from following a rewarding thing or from avoiding something that didn't go as planned. This has really big implications for how quickly you learn to make good choices, but also how aware you are of when the thing you're doing isn't working.
Chantel Pratt with an important book, and as you can say, you can hear, she is full of enthusiasm about the neuroscience of you. Now, Dr. Pratt, as we get older, do our brains change?
Yes, they do. Of course they do. I mean, we're feeding them with experiences. We're becoming more knowledgeable. There are more things in that old file cabinet of data that we're trying to pull out, and sometimes that can get tricky. They slow down in certain important ways. But I think that, you know, true to the spirit of this book, where different doesn't always mean better or worse, I think it's important to note that some of the ways that our aging brains change might have a lot of benefits for things like creative thinking and just the knowledge that experience brings.
Well, as we get older, I'm told that actually people score higher on IQ tests if they're fully functional. So there is an advantage to age, but you said we slow down. How do we, and this is independent of having something like dementia, how do we slow down?
Right. Yeah. So one thing to note in the spirit of individual differences is that there are huge individual differences in how somebody ages, but on average, the resting frequency of our brain, the frequency with which our brain prefers to communicate or take in new packages of information, update our knowledge of what's going on around us, tends to slow down with age. Now, that being said, in one large study that was conducted by Clark, I looked at the group of 60-year-olds, and in that group, both the fastest and the slowest brain existed. So I think our differences continue throughout the lifespan. And one of the main differences you see is how we age, what that looks like.
Should we be fearful of aging?
I don't think so, because it's coming no matter what. I think we should save our fear for things we can avoid.
Well, we can see it in the mirror when we age. And so we're aware of that, but, sometimes it's more subtle when we lose some of our cognitive functions or we slow down, as you say. But there go ahead. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I think thinking about changing rather than losing is probably more accurate than you might think. Like, we get very focused on things being fast or being able to juggle a lot of mental balls. But in fact, you know, there are pros and cons to all of these different information processing spaces. And I think things will change on average when you age, but they might allow you to see the world from a very interesting and important new perspective.
Mm-hmm. Well, I note that in your book, you give credit to one individual. It's not a human, it's your dog, who you say sat by your side for 95% of your writing and elicited oxytocin, not oxycontin. Thank God for that.
She elicited oxycontin.
We might not be talking with you now, but oxytocin. So pets can help us function more properly as well. Correct.
Yes, and yeah, they reduce stress. But you know, one of the things that I think is so powerful with dogs is that we connect with them and they connect with us. They get oxytocin in their brains when they're looking at their owners. And I think, you know, in this space of, do we understand people who work differently? If you love your dog, like I love my dog, you might ask yourself, how wide could my pack be? How could I find similarities? With whom could I find similarities and commonalities? If me and my dog are getting this reciprocal reward bond drug in our brains from being together.
Well, thank you, Chantel Pratt. The book is The Neuroscience of You. Signature support for Talk Louisiana is from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services and Jerry Lane Chevrolet.